Despite the cries of these detractors, the city officials stuck to their plan, slowly expanding their efforts to include more and more subway lines, until all of the trains in the city were clean. And as their circles started to expand, so did their results. Before long, subway crime of all kinds, from fare beating to armed robberies, had dropped rapidly. Then they expanded their circle by cleaning up graffiti in the city at large, and amazingly, they soon saw crime fall across the board. The point? Small successes can add up to major achievements. All it takes is drawing that first circle in the sand. Principle number 6. The 22nd rule. How to turn bad habits into good ones by minimizing barriers to change. During one of the first trainings I ever gave on Wall Street, an impatient-looking man stood up in the back of the room and shouted over the heads of his fellow analysts, "Sean, I know you're from Harvard and everything, but isn't this all a huge waste of time? Isn't positive psychology just common sense?" I felt my heart drop into my stomach. I hadn't yet been in the consulting business long enough to know that being publicly challenged like this comes with the territory. Still, I gathered my wits and did my best to address the inquisitor head on. I started by telling him that positive psychology draws on ideas from many esteemed sources ranging from ancient Greek philosophers to hallowed religious traditions to modern day writers and thinkers. "What's more," I went on, "the principles and theories are then empirically tested and validated. So while some of the ideas espoused by positive psychology may very well be common sense, it's the science behind them that makes them unique and valuable." Clearly, though, this guy just wasn't buying it. He sat back down with a smug look, and I moved on to the next question, trying to accept the fact that you just can't win them all. Not until after the session, as I sat with several of the analysts over lunch, did the significance of this encounter reveal itself. "Do you remember that guy who stood up during your talk?" one of them asked. I said that I very much did. Another analyst leaned in close. "That guy is the most unhappy person here. It's like a rain cloud follows over his head all the time. We can't put him on any teams because he's toxic." This was a turning point for me. Here was someone who had dismissed most of what I'd just been saying is too obvious to even discuss. Yet apparently, it wasn't obvious enough. I realized that he was the living embodiment of one of the greatest paradoxes of human behavior. Common sense is not common action. Would you be surprised if I told you that cigarettes are not a great source of vitamin C, or watching hours of reality television will not dramatically raise your IQ? Probably not. Similarly, we all know we should exercise, sleep 8 hours, eat healthier, and be kind to others. But does this common knowledge make doing these things any easier? Of course not. Because in life, knowledge is only part of the battle. Without action, knowledge is often meaningless. As Aristotle put it, to be excellent, we cannot simply think or feel excellent. We must act excellently. Yet the action required to follow through on what we know is often the hardest part. That's why even though doctors know better than anyone the importance of exercise and diet, 44% of them are overweight. It's also why organizational gurus are often messy, religious leaders can be blasphemous, and why even some positive psychologists aren't happy all of the time. I work with countless business people who complain that every Monday, they make the same resolutions to stop procrastinating or quit smoking, to keep up with their inbox, or start seeing their kids more. Yet every Friday, they find themselves wondering where the week went and what got in their way. The fact of the matter is, positive habits are hard to keep, no matter how commonsensical they might be. Like most people, I wage the same battle every January 1st, and by January 10th, I'm right back where I started. In fact, the New York Times reported that a whopping 80% of us break our New Year's resolutions. Even when we feel committed to positive change, sustaining it for any real length of time can seem nearly impossible. All too often, our pledges go unfulfilled, and today's treadmill becomes tomorrow's clothing rack. If our brains have the capacity to change, as we now know they do, why is changing our behavior so hard, and how can we make it easier? We are mere bundles of habits. During the years I spent working in Harvard's research lab, my workday started with a long ride up the elevator in William James Hall. The 15-story building has been home to Harvard's psychology department for decades, and it has housed more than its fair share of fascinating research, from B.F. Skinner and his famous box to rambunctious bonobo monkeys and genetically engineered rodents, all humanely treated, which is more than we can say for the graduate students. The discoveries made by the building's namesake, though, might be its proudest heritage. While his brother Henry was gaining worldwide fame as a novelist, William James was carving out his own niche in history with his breakthroughs in the field of psychology. Born a few years into the second half of the 19th century, James applied his training in medicine, philosophy, and psychology to his lifelong study of the human mind. He taught Harvard's first experimental psychology class in 1875, and by 1890 had published Principles of Psychology, a 1,200-page tour de force that became the precursor to the modern psychology textbook. As I tell my students every year, think of the poor undergraduates who took William James' class before you complain too loudly about this week's reading assignment. In my mind, though, the greatest contribution William James made to the field of psychology is one that was a full century ahead of its time. Humans, James said, are biologically prone to habit, and it is because we are mere bundles of habits that we are able to automatically perform many of our daily tasks, from brushing our teeth first thing in the morning to setting the alarm before climbing into bed at night. It is precisely because habits are so automatic that we rarely stop and think about the enormous role they play in shaping our behavior, and in fact our lives. After all, if we had to make a conscious choice about every little thing we did all day, we would likely be overwhelmed by breakfast. Take this morning as an example. I'm guessing that you didn't wake up, walk into your bathroom, look quizzically into the mirror, and think to yourself, "Should I put clothes on today?" You didn't have to debate the pros and cons. You didn't have to call on your reserves of willpower. You just did it, the same way you probably combed your hair, gulped your coffee, locked your front door, and so on. And excepting any listeners who are exhibitionists, you did not have to remind yourself all day to keep these clothes on. It was not a struggle. It didn't deplete your reserves of energy or brain power. It was second nature, automatic, a habit. None of this seems particularly groundbreaking to us today, but what William James concluded was indeed crucial to our understanding of behavioral change. Given our natural tendency to act out of habit, James surmised, couldn't the key to sustaining positive change be to turn each desired action into a habit, so that it would come automatically, without much effort, thought, or choice? As the father of modern psychology so shrewdly advised, if we want to create lasting change, we should make our nervous system our ally instead of our enemy. Habits are like financial capital. Forming one today is an investment that will automatically give out returns for years to come. Daily strokes of effort. Of course, this is where the phrase "easier said than done" has particular relevance. Good habits may be the answer, but how do we create them in the first place? William James had a prescription for that too. He called it daily strokes of effort. This is hardly revelatory. Basically, a reworking of the old dictum, practice makes perfect. Still, he was on to something far more sophisticated than he could have possibly have known at the time. A tendency to act, he wrote, only becomes effectively ingrained in us in proportion to the uninterrupted frequency with which the actions actually occur, and the brain grows to their use. In other words, Habits form because our brain actually changes in response to frequent practice. In fact, James had this exactly right, though it would take 100 years before neuroscientists could explain why. Remember how we learned that the brain's structures and pathways are flexible and elastic? Well, it turns out that as we progress through our days learning new facts, completing new tasks, and having new conversations, our brains are constantly changing and rewiring to reflect these experiences. With apologies to the delicate nuances of neuroscience, here is what is happening in a nutshell. Within our brains are billions upon billions of neurons, interconnected in every which way to form a complex set of neural pathways. Electrical currents travel down these pathways from neuron to neuron, delivering the messages that make up our every thought and action. The more we perform a particular action, the more connections form between the corresponding neurons. This is the origin of the common phrase, cells that fire together, wire together. The stronger this link, the faster the message can travel down the pathway. This is what makes the behavior seem second nature or automatic. This is also how we become skilled at an activity with practice. For instance, the first time you try to juggle, the neural pathways involved are unused, and so the message travels slowly. The more time you spend juggling, the more these pathways get reinforced, so that on the 8th day of practice, the electrical currents are firing at a much more rapid pace. This is when you'll notice that juggling becomes easier, requires less concentration, and that you can do it faster. Eventually, you can be listening to music, chewing gum, and having a conversation with someone else, all while those 3 oranges are flying through the air. Juggling has become automatic, a habit, cemented in your brain by a solid new network of neural pathways. Given all that William James had right so many years ago, we should forgive him the one thing he got wrong. He believed, as did most scientists of his day, that this ability to create lasting brain change was exclusive to the young, essentially the you can't teach an old dog new tricks school of thought. Thankfully, that's not the case. As you'll recall from the beginning of this program, scientists now know that the brain remains plastic and malleable well past the age of 20, through even our most senior years. That means that we have the power to create new habits and then reap the benefits whether we're 22 or 72. The guitar that wouldn't play itself. When I first learned about the science behind this phenomenon, I was eager to test it out. Could I really rewire my brain and create a new life habit by doing the same thing each day for a few weeks? It was time for an experiment, and the easiest way to do one was to make myself the subject. I decided to take up the guitar once again, since I already owned one and knew that I enjoyed playing it, because common wisdom had long proposed that it takes 21 days to make a habit. I decided to make a spreadsheet with 21 columns, tape it to my wall, and check off each day I played. By the end of the 3 weeks, I felt confident that A, I would have a grid full of 21 check marks. B, daily guitar playing would have become an automatic, established part of my life. C, my playing would improve. And D, I would be happier for it. 3 weeks later, I pulled the grid down in disgust. Staring up at 4 check marks, followed by a whole lot of empty boxes, was more discouragement and embarrassment than I needed. I had failed my own experiment, and worse, I was no closer to telling potential dates that I was a musician. Worse still, I was shocked, depressed even, at how quick I had been to give up. A positive psychologist should be better at following his own advice. Of course, the feelings of failure only deepen when you realize you're now a depressed positive psychologist. The guitar was still sitting in the closet, a mere 20 seconds away, but I couldn't make myself take it out and play it. What had gone wrong? It turns out that the telling words here are make myself. Without realizing it, I had been fighting the wrong battle, one I was bound to lose unless I changed my strategy. Why willpower is not the way. Tal Ben-Shahar loves to tell what he calls the story of the chocolate cake. Back home in Israel, Tal's mother was famous for her delicious chocolate cake. One afternoon, when Tal and his friends arrived home from school, she pulled one out of the oven and offered everyone a slice. Tal refused, citing his strict training regimen for the National Squash Championships. So he sat and watched enviously as his friends devoured their mouth-watering snack. Then they all went back to their homework. Hours later, Tal returned to the fridge to examine the cake. It still looked delicious, but no, he thought, he would stay strong. Another hour passed, another check on the cake. Yep, still there. Soon, it was all he could think about. Finally, in the middle of the night, when everyone else was sleeping, Tal crept down to the kitchen and devoured the entire remaining cake. Every last bite. Anyone who has ever tried to maintain a strict diet has experienced this failure of willpower. We deny and deny ourselves until all of a sudden, we can't take it anymore, and the floodgates break. 5 successful days of carrot sticks and tofu wedges are followed by a pizza binge or a feast fit for 5. As any dietitian will tell you, relying on willpower to completely avoid unhealthy food nearly guarantees relapse. That's why people who crash diet are more likely to regain weight than people who eat healthily but don't deny themselves. And why only 20% of the dieters are able to keep off the lost weight for any extended length of time. The more we attempt to stay strong, the harder we eventually fall, usually right into a tub of Ben & Jerry's. The point is that whether it's a strict diet, a New Year's resolution, or an attempt at daily guitar practice, the reason so many of us have trouble sustaining change is because we try to rely on willpower. We think we can go from 0 to 60 in an instant, changing or overturning ingrained life habits through the sheer force of will. Tal thought telling himself he was on a diet would be enough to keep him away from his mother's chocolate cake. I thought telling myself to follow some spreadsheet would discipline me enough to practice the guitar. Well, that worked for 4 days. Then I went back to regularly scheduled programming. Willpower gets a workout. The reason willpower is so ineffective at sustaining change is the more we use it, the more worn out it gets. You may know this intuitively, but it took renowned researcher Roy Baumeister hundreds of chocolate chip cookies and a lot of disgruntled research subjects to prove it as fact. In one of many studies on the subject of willpower, Baumeister and his colleagues invited college students into their lab, instructing them not to eat anything for at least 3 hours prior to the experiment. Then he split them into 3 groups. Group 1 was given a plate of chocolate chip cookies, which they were told not to eat, as well as a healthy plate of radishes, which they were welcome to eat to their heart's content. Group 2 was presented with the same 2 plates of cookies and radishes, but they were told they could eat off whichever plate they liked. Group 3 was given no food at all. After enduring these situations for a significant length of time, the 3 groups were then given a set of simple geometric puzzles to solve. Let me emphasize the word simple. In truth, this is another one of psychology's favorite tools, the unsolvable puzzle. As I learned the hard way through my Help the Elderly experience, psychology researchers love using impossible games to see how long participants will persevere at a task. In this case, individuals in group 2 and 3 long outlasted those in group 1, who quickly threw up their hands in defeat. Why? Because the students who had to use every ounce of their willpower to avoid eating the enticing chocolate chip cookies didn't have the willpower or mental energy left to struggle with a complex puzzle. Even though avoiding cookies and persisting on a puzzle are seemingly completely unrelated. Studies have replicated this finding with a huge range of tasks designed to tap willpower. In one, people were asked to watch a humorous film and suppress their laughter. then solve difficult anagrams. In another, they were instructed to write about a day in the life of an obese person without using any stereotypes. Then we're told to suppress a specific thought. Don't think about a white bear. And indeed, no matter what the tasks were, they always performed significantly worse on the second than the first. If they had resisted laughter for 10 minutes, they couldn't persist on an anagram. If they had suppressed stereotypes, they couldn't avoid thinking about a white bear. And so on. The point of these experiments was to show that no matter how unrelated the tasks were, they all seemed to be tapping the same fuel source. As the researchers wrote, many widely different forms of self-control draw on a common resource, or self-control strength, which is quite limited and hence can be depleted readily. Put another way, our willpower weakens the more we use it. Unfortunately, we face a steady stream of tasks that deplete our willpower every single day. Whether it's avoiding the dessert table at the company lunch, staying focused on a computer spreadsheet for hours on end, or sitting still through a three-hour meeting, our willpower is consistently being put to the test. So it's no wonder, really, that we so easily give in to our old habits, to the easiest and most comfortable path as we progress through the day. This invisible pull towards the path of least resistance can dictate more of our lives than we realize, creating an impassable barrier to change and positive growth. The path of least resistance. As Kathy sits tethered to her desk on Tuesday, she daydreams about the upcoming Saturday and all its possibilities. She wants to go biking on the trail by her house, join in a pickup soccer game at the local park, and see that Matisse exhibit at the museum. She might even dive into that pile of books she's been wanting to read. Like all of us, Kathy has a number of hobbies and activities that engage her interests and strengths, energize her days, and make her happy. And yet, when her free Saturday actually does roll around, where does she end up? Conspicuously not on her bike, or at the soccer field, and certainly not at that art exhibit everybody was raving about. It's 20 minutes away. Her remote control, on the other hand, is within very easy reach, and Bravo happens to be airing a Top Chef marathon. 4 hours later, Kathy has sunk deeper and deeper into the couch, unable to shake a listless sense of disappointment. She had better plans for the afternoon, and she wonders what happened to them. What happened to Kathy was something that happens to all of us at one time or another. Inactivity is simply the easiest option. Unfortunately, we don't enjoy it nearly as much as we think we do. In general, Americans actually find free time more difficult to enjoy than work. If that sounds ridiculous, consider this. For the most part, our jobs require us to use our skills, engage our minds, and pursue our goals. All things have been shown to contribute to happiness. Of course, leisure activities can do this too, but because they're not required of us, because there is no leisure boss leaning over our shoulder on Sunday mornings telling us we better be at the art museum by 9 a.m. sharp, we often find it difficult to muster the energy necessary to kickstart them. So we follow the path of least resistance, and that path inevitably leads us to the couch and the television. And because we are mere bundles of habit, the more often we succumb to this path, the more difficult it becomes to change directions. Unfortunately, though these types of passive leisure, like watching TV and trolling around on Facebook, might be easier and more convenient than biking or looking at art or playing soccer, they don't offer the same rewards. Studies show that these activities are enjoyable and engaging for only about 30 minutes. Then they start sapping our energy, creating what psychologists call psychic entropy, that listless, apathetic feeling Kathy experienced. On the other hand, active leisure, like hobbies, games, and sports, enhance our concentration, engagement, motivation, and sense of enjoyment. Studies have found that American teenagers are 2.5 times more likely to experience elevated enjoyment when engaged in a hobby than when watching television, and 3 times more likely when playing a sport. And yet here's the paradox. These same teenagers spend 4 times as many hours watching TV as they do engaging in sports or hobbies. So what gives? Or as psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi put it more eloquently, why would we spend 4 times more time doing something that has less than half the chance of making us feel good? The answer is that we are drawn powerfully, magnetically, to those things that are easy, convenient, and habitual. And it is incredibly difficult to overcome this inertia. Active leisure is more enjoyable, but it almost always requires more initial effort. Getting the bike out of the garage, driving to the museum, tuning the guitar, and so on. Csikszentmihalyi calls this activation energy. In physics, activation energy is the initial spark needed to catalyze a reaction. The same energy, both physical and mental, is needed of people to overcome inertia and kickstart a positive habit. Otherwise, human nature takes us down the path of least resistance time and time again. An offer you can't refuse. As you might imagine, advertisers and marketers make their living on the path of least resistance. Ever bought something with a mail-in rebate? Did you actually mail it in? Didn't think so. That's why companies offer them. This is also why magazines send us a free 5-week subscription, then automatically start deducting money from our account in the 6th week. Sure, we can refuse the offer, as long as we mail back that little card saying, "No thank you, I would like to cancel my subscription." Unfortunately, that requires just too much activation energy, and the gimmick pays off for the magazine. In the world of marketing, the term is opt-out, a genius invention, really, that takes supreme advantage of human psychology. Opt-out marketing is when people are added to mailing lists without ever consciously consenting, so that if they want to stop the barrage of promotional emails, they must actively unsubscribe themselves. To unsubscribe requires finding the tiny link at the bottom of the email, then clicking through 1 or 2 more websites before finally arriving at the desired destination. The company is betting, often successfully, that this process involves far more energy and effort than most people are willing to expend. Martin Lindstrom, a marketing expert who uses neuroscience to explore the psychology of our consumer habits, points out that phone companies are special benefactors of this strategy. There is almost always a better monthly plan available than the one the phone comes with, but we usually stick with the default because it's just too difficult to do the research and then even more difficult to switch plans. One especially fascinating study Lindstrom did on the famous Nokia ringtone, perhaps the most ubiquitous 4-note sound in the world, revealed the powerful pull that the path of least resistance has on us. By using fMRI technology to analyze people's brains during exposure to the sound, he found a nearly universal negative emotional response. And yet, amazingly, 80 million Nokia users have it as their ringtone. Why would they keep the ring that grates on their ears and sends them into an emotional tailspin every time they get a call? Because it's the default option. And whether we're aware of it or not, default options are everywhere, shaping our choices and our behavior in all areas of our lives. At the grocery store, we buy more food off shelves that directly meet our eye and less off those that require us to look up or kneel down. Every retailer knows this, and you can be sure they exploit it by putting the most expensive brands at eye level. Online advertisers now conduct market research with sophisticated eye-tracking machines, determined to develop the perfect place for a banner ad on a website, the place that we will see without expending any additional energy. In clothing stores, too, everything is set up to capitalize on our gravitation to the default path. As Lindstrom points out, we're more likely to buy an item of clothing if we can give it a sensory test run by touching the fabric. So the most expensive clothes are set at the perfect height for such an experience. Try this out the next time you enter a store. When your hands are at your side, each table of clothes sits almost exactly at your fingertips, begging to be grabbed. In the workplace, the path of least resistance is especially maladaptive, luring us into a whole host of bad habits that breed procrastination and undercut productivity. I often encounter this problem in my own professional life, but I had to travel all the way to Hong Kong for the gravity of the situation to really hit home. The path to distraction. It was the second day of the training session I was giving at a large technology company in Hong Kong, a city so electric it makes Times Square look like Topeka. I had found some time to work privately with Ted, one of the lead managers on the marketing team, who was struggling to keep up with his workload. No matter how much he worked, he always felt behind, and he had to keep extending his hours to keep up with it all. "I don't do anything except work now," Ted confessed, "and it's still not enough." I told him that he wasn't alone. I hear the same story, almost word for word, no matter what country I'm in or who I'm talking with. Regardless of our job description, we never seem to have enough time to get everything done. 8-hour workdays turn into 12 and 14-hour ones, and we still feel behind. How can this be? Why do we have so much trouble being productive? After listening to Ted describe, from start to finish, how he went about his day, two important answers suddenly clicked into place. One, Ted was working all the time. And two, Ted was almost never working. When Ted arrives at 7 a.m., the first thing he does is open his internet browser. His homepage is CNN, so he starts reading up on the day's breaking news. His intent is to scan the major headlines and move on, but invariably, he ends up clicking through the other links that catch his eye. Then, without even thinking about it, he opens two different websites where he checks his stocks and investments to see how they fared overnight. Next, he checks his email, which will continue to stay open throughout the day, alerting him every time he receives new messages. Once he wades through his inbox, clicks on a couple more links and attachments, and fires back a few responses, he's ready to get to work. Sort of. Turns out, Ted generally gets about 30 minutes of real work done before he takes a quick coffee break. Then he sits back at the computer, where he can't help but notice that his homepage has a whole new batch of headlines to scan. And what's this? 10 new emails? He better read them. Then he checks his stocks again, just to be sure financial Armageddon hasn't kicked in. Finally, Ted refocuses and gets into a groove, writing a new marketing plan, which lasts for about 10 minutes, until his concentration is broken again by the arrival of a new email. To quote Kurt Vonnegut, and so it goes. Does this sound at all familiar? After a few quick calculations, we concluded that Ted probably checks his stocks 3 times an hour, his email 5 times an hour, and news websites about once an hour. And that's actually quite typical. The American Management Association reports that employees spend an average of 107 minutes on email a day. A group of London workers I spoke with admitted that they check stocks about 4 or 5 times an hour. That's 35 times a day. And I suspect that most office workers tallied up all the minutes they spent each day on blogs, social networking sites, Amazon.com, and so forth. It would paint a very alarming picture indeed. No wonder it's so hard to get anything done. And that's not even the worst of it. The actual time we give to these distractions is part of the problem, but the larger issue is that our attention hits a wall each time we stray. Research shows that the average employee gets interrupted from their work every 11 minutes, and on each occasion experiences a loss of concentration and flow that takes almost as many minutes to recover from. Yet in today's world, it's just too easy for us to be tempted. As a New York Times article put it, distracting oneself used to consist of sharpening a half dozen pencils or lighting a cigarette. Today, there is a universe of diversions to buy, hear, watch, and forward, which makes focusing on a task all the more challenging. As Ted and I worked to find ways to minimize the distractions, I had an epiphany. It's not the sheer number and volume of distractions that get us into trouble. It's the ease of access to them. Think about it. If you want to check your stocks, do you have to sit there and watch the stock ticker run through the whole alphabet? Of course not. You can program a website to update you on the ones you're interested in and give you regular updates. If you want to read the latest political news or some commentary on the hot new movie, do you have to troll through all the dozens of sites and blogs to find one on the desired subject? No way. You can set up an RSS feed for your favorite blog topics and have them delivered right to your inbox. Similarly, you can get all your favorite sports news, celebrity gossip, restaurant reviews, and everything else emailed right to you. Technology may make it easier for us to save time, but it also makes it a whole lot easier for us to waste it. In short, distraction, always just one click away, has become the path of least resistance. Redirecting the path, the 22nd rule. In allowing himself to be swept along this path, Ted had become ensnared in a series of very bad habits. In his case, these all involved procrastination, which got me thinking. Could the psychological mechanisms that were derailing Ted's productivity also explain why I had failed to follow my regimen of guitar playing? Had the path of least resistance led me astray? I thought back to that initial experiment. I had kept my guitar tucked away in a closet, out of sight and out of reach. It wasn't far out of the way, of course. My apartment isn't that big. But just those 20 seconds of extra effort it took me to walk to the closet and pull out the guitar had proved to be a major deterrent. I had tried to overcome this barrier with willpower, but after only 4 days, my reserves were completely dried up. If I couldn't use self-control to ingrain the habit, at least not for an extended period, I now wondered, what if I could eliminate the amount of activation energy it took to get started? Clearly, it was a time for another experiment. I took the guitar out of the closet, bought a $2 guitar stand, and set it up in the middle of my living room. Nothing had changed, except that now, instead of being 20 seconds away, the guitar was in immediate reach. 3 weeks later, I looked up at the habit grid with 21 proud check marks. What I had done here, essentially, was put the desired behavior on the path of least resistance. So it actually took less energy and effort to pick up and practice the guitar than to avoid it. I like to refer to this as the 22nd rule, because lowering the barrier to change by just 20 seconds was all it took to help me form a new life habit. In truth, it often takes more than 20 seconds to make a difference, and sometimes it can take much less. But the strategy itself is universally applicable. Lower the activation energy for habits you want to adopt and raise it for habits you want to avoid. The more we can lower or even eliminate the activation energy for our desired actions, the more we enhance our ability to jumpstart positive change. Sirens and Slurpees. This is not a new idea, but it is a really good one. Remember the scene from Homer's Odyssey where Odysseus tries to guide his ship past the dangerous sirens, those beauties with voices so seductive they could lure any man to certain death? Odysseus knows he will be powerless to resist their call, so he tells his men to tie him to the ship's mast, ensuring that they will sail safely by. Because he knows willpower will fail him, he puts enough activation energy between him and the path of temptation. More than 2,000 years later, and in only a slightly different cultural context, the main character in the movie Confessions of a Shopaholic freezes her credit cards in blocks of ice to physically stop herself from an impulsive buy. Sounds silly, but putting 10 minutes of hair drying and chiseling in between her and her American Express was enough to stall her troubling habit. Sure, this may be an exaggeration. From Hollywood, how surprising. But financial advisors actually do recommend that people who can't resist the siren song of a sale leave their credit cards at home in a desk drawer, safely out of reach. Luckily, shopping isn't one of my big weaknesses, but watching too much television used to be. According to a quick Google search, the average American watches 5 to 7 hours of television a day. At one point, I was watching about 3 hours a day, which was, of course, decreasing my productivity and time with my real-life friends. I wanted to watch less television, but every time I'd come home from work, I would be tired from teaching, and it was so easy to sit down on the couch and press the on button on the remote control. So I decided to do another experiment on myself. This time, I determined to play the same trick my brain had played upon me when I didn't play the guitar. I took the batteries out of the remote control, took my stopwatch, and walked the batteries exactly 20 seconds away and left them in a drawer in my bedroom. Would that be enough to cure me of my TV habit? The next few nights, when I got home from work, I plopped down on the couch and pressed the on button on the remote, usually repeatedly, forgetting that I had moved the batteries. Then, frustrated, I thought to myself, I hate that I do these experiments. But sure enough, the energy and effort required to retrieve the batteries, or even to walk across the room and turn the TV on manually, was enough to do the trick. Soon I found myself reaching for a book I had purposefully placed on the couch, or the guitar that now sat on a stand right by the couch, or even the laptop now positioned in easy reach, on which I was writing this manuscript. As the days passed, the urge to watch TV waned, and the new activities became more habitual. Eventually, I even found myself doing things that required far more activation than retrieving batteries, like going out to play pickup basketball or meeting friends for dinner. And I felt much more energized, productive, and happy for it. By adding 20 seconds to my day, I gained back 3 hours. The 20-second rule is an especially crucial ally in our quest for healthier eating habits. Researchers have found that they can cut cafeteria ice cream consumption in half by simply closing the lid of an ice cream cooler, and that when people are required to wait in another, separate line to purchase chips and candy, far fewer will do so. In essence, the more effort it takes us to obtain unhealthy food, the less we'll eat of it, and vice versa. This is why nutritionists recommend that we prepare healthy snacks in advance so that we can simply pull them out of the refrigerator, and why they recommend that when we do eat junk food, we take out a small portion, then put the rest of the bag away, well out of reach. In his book, Mindless Eating, Brian Wansink writes about a friend of his who couldn't resist stopping at a 7-Eleven to get a Slurpee on his way home from work each day. Finally, he decided that if he couldn't keep his car from driving to 7-Eleven, he would take a different route home, zigzagging around the temptation. Our best weapon in the battle against bad habits, be they Slurpees, Seinfeld reruns, or distractions at work, is simply to make it harder for ourselves to succumb to them. Clever minds have come up with some creative ways to put barriers between ourselves and our vices. For instance, in an increasing number of U.S. states, compulsive gamblers can request that the government put them on a list that actually makes it illegal for them to enter casinos or collect any gambling earnings. Some cell phone carriers offer a service to prevent imbibers from drunk dialing by blocking all outgoing calls, except 911, after a certain hour on weekends. The Google email client Gmail offers an amusing but effective option that requires someone to solve a series of math problems before they can send an email late at night, thereby protecting employees who have downed a bottle of wine from emailing their bosses a misspelled list of grievances. Governments, too, have found a way to use the 20-second rule in service of the greater public good. For example, polls show that the number of people willing to be organ donors is quite high, but that most are deterred by the long process of filling out the right forms to do so. In response, some countries have switched to an opt-out program, which automatically enrolls all citizens as donors. Anyone is free to withdraw their name, of course, but when staying on the list becomes the default option, most people will do so. This really works. When Spain switched to opt out, the number of donated organs immediately doubled. Before I stumbled upon the 22nd rule, I'm not sure I could have done much more to help Ted in Hong Kong than diagnose his paradoxical problem. He was working almost all the time, yet almost never working. But once I realized why he was having so much trouble staying focused, I decided it was time to see how this strategy could take office distractions off the path of least resistance. Save time by adding time. The first step is a seemingly counterintuitive one. Disable many of the shortcuts that were originally designed to save time at the office. For example, I encouraged Ted to keep his email program closed while he worked, so it would no longer send jarring alerts whenever he received new mail. Anytime he wanted to check email, he'd have to actively open the program and wait for it to load. While this reduced involuntary interruptions, it was still too easy for him to click on the little Outlook icon whenever his mind wandered. So to protect against habitual checking, we made it even more difficult. We disabled the automatic login and password for the account, took the shortcut off the computer desktop, then hid the application icon in an empty folder, buried in another empty folder, buried in another empty folder. Essentially, we created the electronic version of Russian stacking dolls. As he told me one day at the office, only half jokingly, it was now a total pain in the ass to check his email. "Now we're getting somewhere," I replied. We did the same thing for his other distractions, disabling his stock widget, changing his homepage from CNN to a blank search page, and even turning off his computer's ability to process cookies so it couldn't remember the stocks and websites he usually checked. Every additional button he was required to click, even every additional address he was required to type into a web browser, raised the barrier to procrastination and improved his chances of remaining on task. I pointed out that he still had complete freedom to do what he wanted. Just like in an opt-out program, his choice had not been taken away at all. The only thing that had changed was the default, which was now set to productivity instead of to distraction. That first day in Hong Kong, Ted was not only skeptical, but a little annoyed with me. It seemed to him, and to the other executives on whom I'd inflicted similar miseries, that I was only making their busy lives more difficult. Who was I to disable their cookies? I don't even know what cookies are. But a few days later, once they realized how much more work they were getting done, and in less time, they had come around. Sleep in your gym clothes. The 22nd rule isn't just about altering the time it takes to do things. Limiting the choices we have to make can also help lower the barrier to positive change. You may recall how Roy Baumeister's willpower studies showed that self-control is a limited resource that gets weakened with overuse. Well, those same researchers have discovered that too much choice, similarly, saps our resources. Their studies showed that with every additional choice people are asked to make, their physical stamina, ability to perform numerical calculations, persistence in the face of failure, and overall focus drop dramatically. And these don't have to be difficult decisions either. The questions are more chocolate or vanilla than they are Sophie's choice. Yet every one of these innocuous choices depletes our energy a little further until we just don't have enough to continue with the positive habit we're trying to adopt. One of the life habits I wanted to create was exercising in the morning. I knew from numerous research studies that exercise in the morning raises your performance on cognitive tasks and gives your brain a win to start a cascade effect of positive emotions. But information is not transformation, because every morning I would wake up and ask myself, "Do I want to exercise?" And my brain would reply, No, I do not. If you've ever tried to start up the habit of early morning exercise, you have probably encountered how easy it is to get derailed by too much choice. Each morning, after the alarm clock sounds, the inner monologue goes something like this. Should I hit the snooze button or get up immediately? What should I wear to work out this morning? Should I go for a run or go to the gym? Should I go to the nearby gym that's more crowded or the quieter gym that's slightly farther away? What kind of cardio should I do when I get there? Should I lift weights? Should I go to kickboxing class or maybe yoga? And by that point, you're so exhausted by all the options, you've fallen back asleep. At least, that's what would happen to me. So I decided to decrease the number of choices I would have to make in order to get myself to the gym. Each night, before I went to sleep, I wrote out a plan for where I would exercise in the morning and what parts of my body I would focus on. Then I put my sneakers right by my bed. Finally, and most important, I just went to sleep in my gym clothes. And my mom wonders why I'm not married yet. But the clothes were clean, and I had essentially decreased the activation energy enough so that when I woke up the next morning, all I had to do was roll off my bed, put my feet, which already had socks on them, into my shoes, and I was out the door. The decisions that seemed too daunting in my groggy morning state had been decided for me ahead of time, and it worked. Eliminating the choices and reducing the activation energy made getting up and going to the gym the default mode. As a result, once I ingrained a lifetime positive habit of morning exercise, I now don't have to sleep in my gym clothes anymore. Subsequently, in talking to athletes and non-athletes worldwide, I hear the same from both. Something weird happens in the human brain when you put your athletic shoes on. You start to think it is easier to just go work out now than to take all this stuff back off again. In reality, it's easier to take off the shoes, but your brain, once it has tipped toward a habit, will naturally keep rolling in that direction, following the path of perceived least resistance. This isn't just about getting yourself to exercise. Think of the positive changes you want to make at your job and figure out what it would mean to just get your shoes on at work. The less energy it takes to kickstart a positive habit, the more likely that habit will stick. Set rules of engagement. Whether you're trying to change your habits at work or at home, the key to reducing choice is setting and following a few simple rules. Psychologists call these kinds of rules second-order decisions because they are essentially decisions about when to make decisions, like deciding ahead of time when, where, and how I was going to work out in the morning. Of course, this technique isn't just good for decisions like whether to use the treadmill or Stairmaster. In his brilliant book, The Paradox of Choice, Barry Schwartz explains how setting rules in advance can free us from the constant barrage of willpower-depleting choices that make a real difference in our lives. If we make a rule to never drive a car when we've had more than one drink, for example, we eliminate the stress and uncertainty of trying to make a judgment call every time we aren't sure if we're too drunk to drive, which probably means we are. At work, setting rules to reduce the volume of choice can be incredibly effective. For example, if we set rules to only check our email once per hour or to only have one coffee break per morning, we are less likely to succumb in the moment, which helps these rules to become habits we stick to by default. Rules are especially helpful during the first few days of a behavior-changing venture, when it's easier to stray off course. Gradually, as the desired action becomes more habitual, we can become more flexible. For instance, you won't often hear an experienced chef say, "I make it a rule to always follow the recipe exactly as it is," because some of the best dishes are made through creative experimentation in the kitchen. But for a beginning cook like me, this rule is entirely necessary. Since I don't know enough about cooking to know how to be spontaneous, straying from the rules could lead to disaster, or to a dozen tuna fish brownies. I once worked with an account executive named Joseph, who needed rules at work the same way I needed rules in the kitchen. He was a pretty reserved, somber individual. In dress and manner, he reminded me of one of those 17th century New England preachers. That was just on the surface, though. Deep down, Joseph desperately wanted to capitalize on the happiness advantage by spreading positivity to his team. But acting upbeat and openly encouraging his employees just didn't come naturally to him. Each morning, he would set out to be more positive, but always found himself quickly falling back into his default mode. He admitted to me that when he attempted positive interaction during his team meetings, he would get overwhelmed by choices like, what should I say that's encouraging? To whom? When should I say it? How much praise should I give? Paralyzed by indecision, he'd end up saying nothing at all, and the meeting would end with Joseph once again silently lamenting another missed opportunity. All these decisions had required too much activation energy. We needed to set some rules to make this easier. The first rule was this. Every day, before he walked through the conference room doors, he had to think of one employee he could thank for something. Then, the second rule was, before he started the meeting and anything else could get in the way, he had to publicly thank that person. A simple sentence would do, and then he could move on to the rest of the meeting as planned, without the myriad choices hanging over his head. A month later, I happened to be back at the company for a training session when I ran into Joseph in the hallway. No one would have described him as ebullient, but he certainly appeared happier and warmer than before. He told me that our daily rule had made it far easier for him to follow through on his goal, and he was enjoying the benefits of increased positivity in the workplace. In fact, 2 weeks into his new ritual, he found himself wanting to say a second positive comment to someone later on in the meeting, even though he had already reached his goal. Now he could relax the rules, confident the new habit was firmly in place. It's all in the shoes. This book is full of ways we can capitalize on the happiness advantage. But without actually putting those strategies into action, they remain useless, like a set of expensive tools that sit locked behind a glass case. The key to their use, to permanent, positive change, is to create habits that automatically pay dividends without continued concerted effort or extensive reserves of willpower. The key to creating these habits is ritual, repeated practice, until the actions become ingrained in your brain's neural chemistry. And the key to daily practice is to put your desired actions as close to the path of least resistance as humanly possible. Identify the activation energy, the time, the choices, the mental and physical effort they require, and then reduce it. If you can cut the activation energy for those habits that lead to success, even by as little as 20 seconds at a time, it won't be long before you start reaping their benefits. The first step, metaphorically, and sometimes literally, is just to get your shoes on. Principle number 7, social investment. Why social support is your single greatest asset. I was 18 years old, lost in a burning building, and blind. As I fumbled through the flames, it occurred to me, maybe I shouldn't have volunteered for this. It was my senior year of high school, and I was coming to the tail end of my 90 hours of volunteer firefighting training in my hometown of Waco, Texas. The final test before completing the training was called the Fire Maze, an exercise in which the veteran firefighters would put us newbies through our first real-life, full-scale fire. Weighed down with flame-repellent suits, oxygen tanks, and dread, we were led to an empty farm silo called the smoke tank. The firefighters opened the metal door to reveal a giant room filled with an intricate wooden maze, with walls 10 feet high and combustibles like oil tires and pieces of wood littering the floor. Before we could even have time to take in the whole scene, the veteran firefighters put torches to the wood and the entire maze lit up in flames. The Texas sun had already heated the day to nearly 100 degrees, but that seemed cool compared to the furnace blast now racing through the building. We picked up our masks, only to find that they had been completely covered in